There we go. Now we got it. Okay, it's 1:30, everybody. Hope y'all had a good lunch and ready to get back at it. Okay. All right. We're going to go into our biological data collection programs and sampling design. Lee Paramore, you're up.
Oh, it's green now.
There we go. All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I've met most everybody, but a few of you guys I've not formally met. My name is Lee Paramore. I'm the biology supervisor in our manual office with Fisheries Management. And today, the presentation is really just informative. I'm going to discuss our biological data collection programs and also the sample design that goes into developing our programs. So just some terminology and things that we'll be using for the talk, I just provided some terms here. First, there's a sampling program. This isn't any of our sampling programs that are designed to meet our collection needs for biological data to represent information for a specified population. You're going to hear the term survey design quite a bit. This is a scientific sampling plan used to choose a representative sample of elements from a specified population. Then you're going to hear the term sample. This is just a set of items or measurements that are drawn from a population. And then finally, the term population is just all of the individuals that are occurring in the wild. Could be fish stocks, could be fishermen, that type of thing, from which we're trying to draw inferences from. So your sampling program provides a sample design, collect the samples within the sampling program to draw inferences about the population. Survey design is critical to providing reliable information, allows fish stocks to be assessed and management strategies to be implemented, and this helps to provide for the long-term sustainability of our species. This presentation will provide an overview of different survey designs used by the division. In the presentation, I will seek to provide some insight into the purposes for different survey types, provide a distinction between different survey types, and discuss some of the strengths and limitations of different survey types and designs. So biological data collection sources can vary greatly, but they typically fall into two categories. You hear the terms quite a bit, either fishery-independent or fishery-dependent surveys or data. Fishery-independent surveys include our scientific sampling programs where we actually go set our own gear. We fish the gear and we control the situation and the circumstances. So they follow a specified protocol on how the gear is deployed, how it's retrieved. They're completely independent from either the commercial or the recreational fishery. In contrast, as the name implies, fishery dependent are the surveys where we actually go out and interview fishermen, commercial and recreational. This includes things like trip tickets, krill surveys, fish house data, observer data, and so on. During the talk today, I'll refer back and contrast between both of these two types of sampling. So first, I want to cover the basics of a fishery independent data. As I said, fishery independent data, the scientifically conducted surveys that the division does, they have specific purposes, and this is important. First, the purpose is to track trends in species over time. The longer the series, the more valuable the data is in making inferences about the population. Fishery-independent surveys also, depending on the type of survey that is used, can provide information on the age and size structure of the population and how it changes over time. Other information that can be derived include things such as size at age, sex ratio, age at maturity, stock identification through genetics and other sources, and also predator and prey relationships. Sample design is very critical to success of a fishery independent program. Lack of survey design will lead to biased data that is not reliable. Surveys may be specific to a species, or they may encounter and track a number of species, depending on how they're designed. But regardless, the species' life histories must overlap in time and space in order for the survey to be effective. So the survey must encompass both the area and season where the species occurs. Sampling effort must be standardized. This is typically a measure of time, such as the amount of time the gear is actively fishing. For an example, a trawl survey would have a set tow time, and that would be strictly adhered to. For a gill net, this might be the soak time from deployment to the time of retrieval of the net. Such as some of our surveys, we set sunset, fish at sunrise, and have try to keep it as close to a 12-hour soak as we can. The gear must be standardized in terms of its configuration. For example, a net might include strict protocol of mesh sizes, hanging ratios, twine sizes, and so on. You must have standardized deployment and fishing methods. These may relate to how the gear is set, how the gear is fished to retrieve. An example of this is, like in our SANE protocol, the net must be deployed strictly perpendicular to shore, pulled in a half arc back to shore, but you have to pull the net actually into the current when you fish it. Sampling locations are critical and are predetermined, and this must be adhered to. Location selection depends on survey design, though, however. For the division, we have two types of surveys. We have fixed station surveys, where we go back, sample the same stations over time every year. And then we have our stratified random surveys that are randomly selected, and I'll talk about both of those survey types here in a minute. So just to summarize some of the main points regarding fishery independent data, sample design and adherence to strict sampling protocol is critical because it reduces the potential for bias. Bias is anything that impacts the survey's ability to obtain a true measure of the sample population. By standardizing methods, the survey results reflect changes in the population over time and not simply changes to the sample design. So anytime you change the sample design, you're not going to be able to tell whether the changes in the index are a reflection of changing how you're fishing or actually changes in the population. So we try to keep things as standardized as possible. For this same reason, it's critical that sampling not be based on judgment or convenient sampling. We don't simply go where we think we can catch fish. And also cannot be based on the inherent skill or ability of the sampler, meaning some people are probably better at setting nets than other people. If it's based on the skill of the sampler, as personnel changes occur, we're going to have bias in our sampling over time. The question is often asked as to why we didn't put our gear in a particular spot, why we didn't target a school of fish. And as I said before, anytime you deviate from the protocol, you introduce bias and you make interpreting the survey results less reliable than what could have been if the sample had been standardized. I'm talking about fixed stations here just a little bit. Several NCDMF surveys are fixed station surveys. Just as the name implies, these surveys sample the same stations over time. As with any survey, the value of the survey increases as the time series increases. In the figure, you see trawl locations for our fixed station shallow water trawl, juvenile trawl survey, this program 120. This type of survey uses standardized methods. It's primarily favorable because of logistical and economic reasons, being a fixed station survey. In terms of an index, an advantage is that the stations, or I should say a disadvantage, the primary disadvantage of this is that the stations can change over time. This can be a bias as it becomes unclear if the survey is measuring trends in the population or simply is measuring changes in the habitat that are occurring at those specific stations. An advantage to this type of survey, just for that same very reason, is that it can be used to monitor changes over time at sampling sites, such as changes in habitat, development, those sorts of things. So it has some value, but it also has some drawbacks, and those have to be considered depending on how you're going to use the data. Examples of fixed station surveys include our Najimis trawl stations and SANE stations. These are used for striped bass, also for shad, river herring, some for perch and catfish. We also have the shallow water trawls, which I showed you a figure of on the previous slide. This occurs throughout North Carolina coastal waters for estuarine species such as spot, croaker, weakfish, flounder, and others. Then at the bottom in the picture here, you see picture of our Red Drum SANE surveys, which is a fixed station site, which in the last 3 years we've been working with UNCW trying to add a random component to this survey. So, and I'll explain why in just a second, but that gives us a good index of our of Red Drum. So the the pictures of the fish you see there, is the top is a juvenile red drum and the bottom one is a juvenile croaker. Look very similar, but slightly different. So the second type of survey is a stratified random survey. Stratified random surveys are statistically superior to the fixed station surveys we just talked about. Unlike fixed station surveys, station bias is not really a factor in a random survey. And this type of survey, samples are randomly selected within some unifying characteristic termed a strata. Strata can be various things such as area, time, depth, habitat type, or any other unifying characteristic. The purpose of strata is to account for known sources of variation that occur within the survey. And by knowing for this variation, you can allow, by sampling within strata, to have better precision for a given number of samples that are acquired. As a random survey using standardized collection methods, this type of survey over time will produce a representative sample of a proportion of the population that is susceptible to the gear that's being used. The division has several stratified random independent surveys. Good examples include the Pamlico Sound Survey. That was the map I just showed you on the previous slide. This provides indices of abundance for many species, particularly for juvenile abundance. Target species include weakfish, southern flounder, croaker, spot, summer flounder, and blue crabs. The division also conducts adult independent gillnet survey that targets striped bass, red drum, weakfish, southern flounder, spotted sea trout, striped mullet, spot, Atlantic croaker, and other species in Albemarle Sound. We also have a survey in Pamlico Sound. We've extended that to the Pamlico, Pungo, and Neuse Rivers. And most recently, we've extended it to southern components of the state to include Core Sound, Bogue Sound, White Oak Rivers, New River, and Cape Fear River. Both of these surveys serve to provide indices of abundance and also information on habitat use. If I can get my mouse.
Why is it not working? Why is it stuck up there?
Technology error. Okay, finally, the division has an adult longline survey that targets red drum. This occurs in Pamlico Sound during the summer and early fall. This survey captures large adult red drum and has also been used to tag and document coastal sharks occurring within the estuary. Now we want to to shift gears and talk about the fishery-dependent surveys that we discussed earlier. These are the types of data that are collected directly from either recreational or commercial fisheries. Fishery-dependent data has specific purposes, much like independent surveys, but they're very different. The main two purposes for fishery-dependent surveys are to determine removals from the population occurring as a result of either the recreational or commercial fisheries, and they can also provide length and age data to characterize the catch from each sector. Auxiliary data, similar to the independent data, such as sex, maturity, genetics, diet, can also be collected from these surveys. Here we see some of the primary sources used to capture biological data from our commercial and recreational fisheries. Some surveys, such as trip ticket program, are considered census surveys. In this census survey, you're assuming that you're sampling the complete population. In this case, we say that every fish sold is required to have a trip ticket recorded by a fish dealer. While most other surveys sampled are representative of the selected portion of the population that is sampled to determine the characteristics of the whole population. On the slides, we see examples of fisheries-dependent sampling programs, including our trip ticket program. This provides commercial landings by species. It also provides number of trips and number of participants by gear type, location, and date. The observer program provides estimates of discards by species size in the commercial fishery. Fish house sampling provides data to characterize the size and age of species harvested in the commercial fisheries. And then we have our tagging program, which provides information on movement, migration, of different species of fish, as well as mortality rates. And then we have our recreational survey. The Effective fishery dependent sampling must provide sampling that is representative of the catch. For example, sampling effort by area and season would mirror that of catches and effort in the fishery. Ideally, sampling would be random, but is not always practical in this type of survey for logistical reasons. Primary purpose of fishery dependent data is to monitor removals, including harvest and discards, to monitor and characterize gear being used, to characterize the catch in terms of the species captured, and finally to characterize the size and ages and the catch of the species. In the figure, we just see an example of the various locations of fish houses throughout the state that are sampled. Regardless of whether a commercial fishery or a recreational fishery is being characterized, many factors impact when and where fishing effort takes place. Additionally, the methods used in either fishery can vary greatly. Unlike fishery independent sampling, where methods for capturing fish are carefully standardized, commercial and recreational fisheries have no such controls. So we can see here that regulations and weather conditions, market conditions, availabilities of species, and other factors impact when and where fisheries occur. So these certainly are not standardized. The amount of gear set, the size of the gear that can be used can vary greatly. Locations and methods chosen are based on maximizing success. The skill of the fisherman plays a role in the success, and all of these factors are very contrary to the controlled methodology employed in fishery independent sampling. For this reason, fishery dependent data are not ideal for tracking abundance of a population over time or for describing the size and age of fish in a population at large. They can certainly describe the size and age of fish that are harvested, but or even captured, but certainly not the population at large. Both fishery independent and dependent data are critical, and both are key to stock assessments and allowing for sound management advice. Given proper sample design, fishery independent surveys minimize sample bias and allow trends in abundance to be tracked over time. Fishery-dependent surveys have their role. While not ideal for tracking abundance, they function primarily to allow total removals from the population to be monitored, as well as provide estimates of the size and age of fish taken from the population. Now a little bit about sample design and sample error. No survey is perfect, and all surveys have error associated with their estimates. Error is presented by some measure of precision given around the sample mean or point estimate, and you can see that in the graph shown on the slide. The size of sampling error will depend on several factors, but there are three primary ones. The first is sample design. As previously discussed, it is critical in minimizing the potential for bias through sampling error. The second is inadequate sample size. This will always result in large sampling error. And finally, populations with high natural variability will have high sampling error, basically meaning you'll have to collect more samples in order to bring the error down. In general, increasing sample size will increase the precision and reduce the sampling error. This is ideal, but logistics and funding are often a limiting factor in obtaining really large sample sizes. It should be noted that when stock assessments are conducted, all survey data are closely evaluated based on these considerations, and determinations must be made as to whether the inclusion of a survey is appropriate. Additionally, when a survey is selected for inclusion in a model, not only are the point estimates of the survey used, but also these measures of precision are taken into account and are actually put into the model, so the model sort of has an idea of the confidence that we have in the data. So finally, here is just a simple schematic showing how all the data sources come together to provide information for a stock assessment. So this is just a very simplistic look. Fishery-dependent data comes from various different types of sources, and those are on the left in the yellow or the gold. They inform the model on total fishing-induced removals from the population, including harvest and discards. Information provided gives both the magnitude of the removals as well as the size and age of removals. On the right side in the blue, you see we have fishery independent sources, and these typically provide different types of indices for different life stages of the fish. Typically, we have an age zero index that gives us some idea of the recruitment coming into the fishery, And then we'd have an adult index, which gives us some idea of the trends in the population over time. Finally, both fishery independent and fishery dependent sources are used to evaluate life history parameters, which things like maturity, size of maturity, natural mortality, and those types of factors are very important in stock assessments. It is important to distinguish between the roles of all these data sources play. Fishery dependent data have primary purpose of informing on removals from the population, while fishery independent surveys have the primary purpose of monitoring trends in the population over time. It is the combination of these data sources that really allows us to have the most robust stock assessment information. So I think with that, I can certainly take any questions. Laura's talk will certainly dovetail with mine. So.
Let me see if I can phrase this correctly. So if you take the range of a species and you have a certain amount of samples that you're getting, what is what percentage of the range, I guess, is acceptable for like a peer-reviewed stock assessment? So like, how do you determine that, I guess? Does that make any sense?
When you say range, you're talking about the around the...
Yeah, like where they're found. Like, say, a certain species is found from North Carolina to Florida or whatever. How do you... And you're going... You come up with a stock assessment. You've done your sampling. How do they determine whether your sample size is sufficient for peer review of that stock assessment?
Okay, so for the first step for what you're asking, I think, would be defining what the stock unit is for that population. So you're going to want to, you may have genetic information, you may have tagging information, and you're going to know if you're managing that stock, are you going to have impact on that stock in terms of how are you going to, if you manage it, if it's a North Carolina stock, like I'm familiar with red drum, and we know from tagging information that our red drum typically very rarely goes south, but they do intermingle with Virginia. So that's our stock unit, is Virginia and North Carolina.
Gotcha.
Genetic information sort of validates that. I don't know if that answers your question or
not. No, that does, but when you come up with your amount of the amount of surveys that you do or fishery independent surveys, how do you know that you've done enough? And how do you know that you've completely covered that specific area, or what measures do they use for that?
So in those types of situations, like with the flounder, we went to the other states to get the spatial coverage of where those species were occurring in the different states and included those surveys as well as our surveys, because they're all going to contribute to what's occurring in those areas. Typically models cover the spatial unit of the stock. There are more complex models where you can actually have a spatial component where the different surveys will actually inform in those areas what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious about like places that we can't, with the gear that we have, that we can't particularly sample, and we're not really getting to that. How do we quantify that? So if we can only, we're using one acceptable type of sampling, say a trawl survey or whatever, and we can't get a trawl survey in part of the range, how is that kind of accounted for in the stock assessment?
Okay, so to the extent that part of the population that you're not sampling, if that population is represented by the portion that you are sampling, you really don't have a bias. If there's a portion of the population that's characteristically different than the portion that you're sampling, then you would have a bias.
Gotcha.
So okay. In the cases of our surveys, like our gillnet survey, for instance, we don't gillnet in the entire Pamlico Sound.
Right.
But for certain species, we assume that the areas and locations that we are sampling are representative of the whole.
Right.
And
right.
So there's, like I said, no sampling, no sample design is perfect. There's logistic reasons mm-hmm. why you can't sample everywhere. But you certainly have to select your gear in a manner that your selectivity of your gear is representative of what's available in the population. Either that or you have to know what the biases are so you can account for them. You have to select the time and season of where those species occur, and you certainly have to sample in the spatial areas where those species occur. And to the extent you don't, you either have to be able to account for what you're not doing, or you have to assume that what you are sampling is representative.
Gotcha. Okay. I think that pretty much.
Yeah. Pete, you got a question?
Got a question. and this has been batted over time and time again, but fixed station sampling is absolutely one of the most hazardous things you can do statistically speaking. I think you would probably agree with me about that. Why does DMF still hold on to several of their programs that are fixed station samples, like the Albemarle Sound Juvenile Abundance Index, whereas over time you may have had local population extinctions or habitat changes or something like that? That's always concerned me, that program and some of the Eocene programs weren't more randomized.
Yeah, and I think I tried to emphasize that a little bit in the talk. Certainly a random or a stratified random survey, statistically speaking, is more valid in terms of measuring precision and standard errors and things that are associated with the survey. Fixed station surveys do have certainly some drawbacks. They do have some value. There are some analysis to look at fixed station surveys through persistence of stations that you can actually sort of validate whether that survey is giving you a good indication of what you're trying to measure. I'm not familiar with any analysis on the specific surveys that you've done, but I know for Program 120, where we have used it in some stock assessments, the persistence analysis that we did show that it was a valid survey for what we were trying to measure, that particular species. But it is a concern, and to your point, like with our red drum seine surveys, for the last 3 years we've been working with Fred Scharf at UNCW, trying to add a random component to our fixed station red drum seine survey. The red drum seine survey, actually, we published a paper probably 10 or so years ago, actually was a really good indicator of your class strength for red drum, and it is a fixed station survey. But I had the same concerns you're saying, is that, you know, through development and habitat changes over time, you do see some deterioration of stations. That becomes a concern. Sometimes they develop an area, or you have shoaling and you have to shift the station over to a new area, so that's a bias. So we are looking at ways of incorporating at least some random component to some of these fixed station surveys, but still trying to preserve the long-term data sets that we do have on those surveys, because they do have value. But certainly random, stratified random, are superior to fixed station surveys and certainly more statistically valid. So,
okay. Anybody else? Okay. Lee, thank you very much. Laura, you want to go on into your presentation?
I'll stay there.